And this guy who was in charge of the promotion department, Ray Anderson, who also has passed away, was a good-looking, good promotion guy, but he really just liked pop music. And I played him the song, and the guys that were the locals from the Southeast and Southwest were like, they were salivating, and he went, "What the fuck do you want me to do with the goddamn cowboy music?" I looked at him and I said, "Get the fucking thing on the goddamn air in the Southeast and Southwest, and then we'll talk again."
Hello, and welcome to episode number 3 of The Zach Kuhn Show. Thanks for tuning in. My guest today does not need much of an introduction. Throughout his legendary career running RCA and Sony Nashville, Joe Galante changed the Nashville music business and worked with some of the most legendary acts in country music along the way. Acts like Waylon Jennings, Alabama, Brad Paisley, Kenny Chesney, Dolly Parton, and so many more. If you want to know how a kid from Astoria, New York ended up being a power player in Nashville, Tennessee, then this episode is for you. Okay, let's dive in. Okay, we are recording. Joe, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
No problem.
Well, it is a crazy time right now, and there's so much going on in the music business, and I thought I would love to talk with you and sort of hear your thoughts about what's happening and the reaction, the responses to everything going on. But I kind of wanted to start with the music and just lead with something a little more lighthearted. How'd you sign Alabama?
That actually, Sheila Biddy, who was Sheila Shipley at that point, was the receptionist for RCA, and her husband, or ex-husband at that point, was on WSM. And he said to her, "You need to tell Joe about this." And I went down to the CRS show that Alabama played on when they were on MDJ, came back and told Jerry Bradley that we need to get this band, and it just so happened that Jerry Bradley was thinking the same thing because somebody else had told him. So we sat down and made a deal with them back then, with MDJ Records, who was their label at that time, and then years later bought out MDJ Records. I bought out MDJ Records, and they just became an RCA act.
Now, I've heard you say that, in your opinion, typically it's the bands with the buzz where everyone is sort of chasing the band that will usually not make it. It's usually the band that's coming through the ranks over years and building the fan base. Did Alabama have buzz when you signed them, or were they the band that was going through the grind and creating the fan base?
They were going through the grind and creating the fan base. Unlike somebody like Dave Matthews, who had done the Southeast, they were more on the coast. And obviously they were able to sell tickets, but it was, let's face it, it was 1980. What did anybody know of anything at that point in terms of buzz? You know, it was hardly a buzz at that point if you were big in Myrtle Beach. But what was a buzz was the music. I mean, people that heard it just kept raving about it. And I would imagine, you know, 5 or 6 years later, if they were that kind of buzz band, they would have had a lot bigger buzz. But at that point, just, you know, my home's in Alabama is getting some play, and people were talking about the record, and when people did play it, they got phone calls. So that was the buzz.
So what did it look like to create the band? Because that was sort of one of the times where the album was representing the trucks, which was named after the tour. The branding was so genius at that time. How were you coming up with these ideas? Or looking back on the history, like, that was sort of one of the first massive major country tours. What did the branding and the piling of that look like at the time?
It really came, you know, just like you used to name albums for singles. I mean, there were very few albums that came out back then that people said, "Well, I'm not going to name it for one of my singles on the album. I'm going to come up with some abstract title that will really summarize that." And the boys, you know, when you heard the songs, whether it be, you know, 40 Hour Week or Mountain Music, it kind of led you to the idea of where you wanted to go with the brand for the tour. And also, we had used various photographers from around the country. You know, everybody normally was utilizing people in Nashville. And with Alabama, we were bringing in people from around the country. L.A. and New York to photograph them to give them that look when you see the imagery on that. And there's another guy here in Nashville named Dave Hogan who actually did a number of those early videos and was responsible for the graphics and the logo at that point in Alabama. So this was the band, myself, the graphic artist, the video director. I mean, everybody kind of contributed on that. And, you know, that's what really built it.
And when you heard Dixieland Delight for the first time or Mountain Music, did you know how big of a monster hit they were going to become? Or like, what did you think when you heard those songs for the first time? Did you know they were going to be huge?
You know, when you think about, if you look at the chart at that point and what was going on, most of it was straight on really good country music. We had a lot of great singers. You still had the people like the Dollies and the Merles and the Waylons and everybody else were in the mix. So it was a really marvelous time for country music. But there was no band that spoke that Southern English and rocked. And that's what the boys did and had that overtone of country. You know, it was rare to see guys with those kind of haircuts and look getting accepted by the traditional country audience and a bunch of college kids. And so don't forget, you know, everybody talks about Alabama now like they are iconic, but at that time when we were working them, those first two records, we were pretty much southeast, southwest. I mean, we had gold records at that point in the south and the southwest, and that started getting the platinum. But it took us 2 years to really convince the Midwest, the West Coast, and then finally the East Coast that, you know, these guys were for real. I mean, we were getting airplay and having hit records, but we weren't doing the numbers because the distribution chains, you know, those people wouldn't allow it to be in the East because, you know, Tower Records would go, nobody's going to buy this, you know, and then eventually they put it in after, you know, we worked on them, had them play the convention, and little by little, they became what they are now, where there wasn't a market in the country that they weren't accepted in. But it was years of work, and it wasn't overnight.
And how did you pick, because obviously they weren't the only band that RCA was working at the time, and, you know, there's always that decision of, this isn't working, let's keep investing because this is going to connect, or, well, hang on, maybe this isn't working, period. How did you have the confidence in them to keep pushing forward?
Well, I mean, from the moment we put it out there, we got reaction. And then we did a club tour around the country at that point. We went into rock and roll clubs with the band very early on. I remember getting on American Airlines and flying across the country with the guys playing everything from the Bottom Line to the Whiskey. And, you know, brought in all the country stations and, you know, the media and everybody else, and everybody walked away and said, I'm witnessing the Beatles for country music. So that was universal. We didn't go to any place where people went, I don't get it. You know, everybody got it and they were excited and they knew that there was no confusion. They were a band that was for the format and they were of the format. And so the industry supported them from the beginning, and then we got the consumers on board at the same time. Phone calls would come through, and I mean, the great thing about those guys for years is, you know, we'd walk in and we'd say, okay, what do you got? And we'd go, well, I've got this song, you know, My Home's in Alabama. Oh, okay, you know, and then there's one called Tennessee River. Okay, and then we got this Mountain Music. Okay, and then you got, you know, Dixieland a lot. And then we got, it just goes on. I mean, they really, you know, Howell and the boys did a great job of being able to find songs on a regular basis, and they spent the time making those records that, you know, from the moment you hear the first guitar lick, you know who it is. And I think that's one of the great things about that makes them, like so many other great acts along the way, the Eagles, you know, you hear the guitar intro on one of those nights and you go, I know who that is. You know, or if you hear Elton John, and you know, it's the same. You hear it and you know who they are. And everything they did, there were licks all the way through that that made them who they are.
So iconic. Okay, so I want to jump ahead to today, right now. And obviously the music industry is, you know, all upside down with everything going on. And what I was really thinking about when I started thinking about you was when all these artists are currently deciding, okay, do I release my album in this time? Sam Hunt put his album out last week, or if they push and they delay through the crisis and they release it after the crisis, and the pros and cons. And I was curious, if you were running the label during this time, how would you look at the data, or what things would you look at to decide if you're a specific artist should be putting out music right now or not?
You know, it's an interesting question, Jack. Obviously, if you're through the gauntlet and people know who you are, if you're Eric Church, if you're Kenny Chesney, and you're releasing new music, most likely people are going to be interested. What makes it harder is the people in the middle and the people at the bottom, because you're not seeing tons of ads right now going to lots of new. And regardless of whether you're getting new, it doesn't mean that people are digesting. I mean, during the course of the day, how much of your mind share, your ear share, is going to COVID? Just listening, reading. I mean, 10%, 20%, 30%? What do you think is happening in your life?
Oh, I would say probably around 20 to 25%. And I'd also say that I think when I am listening to music right now, it's more of feel-good music. I don't think I'm absorbing as much new music right now.
And that would be my point, is that trying to get people to spend the time on what you think is important is triply hard. It's three times as hard as it was 3 weeks ago. And I just think that you've got to be careful, because just to assume that people will absorb. So you can't stay on the same schedule. You can't stop what you're doing. So there has to be a happy medium, and a happy medium has to be, you know, how do I get these new kids through? What am I going to do for it? And it's just hard. And the good stuff will continue to rise, and you will see signs. It may not be the same numbers of streams that you had before, but when you compare it to other acts out there, you'll see that it stands out a little bit more. It won't be as good as it was before, but it will show you, in the midst of myself comparing to other acts, I'm doing better than. And it's just going to take more patience. And also, you have to be patient with the consumer, because just, you know, we're not going to go back to normal anytime soon. So you've got to be patient enough to go, okay, you know, what I thought should happen normally, I would get through in 26 weeks. It may take me a year to get this act through. It may take me a year and a half. But if you still believe and you're seeing the signs, then you stay with it.
You're so known for creating such brands, like we said, with Alabama or Kenny Chesney or whoever else. And now it feels like you're on such a crutch of what you're able to do. You can't shoot high budget music videos. Obviously, you can't be on the road. If you were working a young act right now, or advice to a young act, how would you think about keeping the fans engaged and making sure that they don't forget about them and that the artist can be part of this time for the fans?
Well, I think the good news about an artist today is, you know, depending on your connections, there are several benefits going on. There are lots of live streams with your buddies. I would be reaching out to people to make it interesting. I mean, how do you cut through the clutter? If you're doing the same stuff you did 3 weeks ago, you're not going to cut through the clutter. So what would make you more interesting? What combination would it be? Doing cover songs? Would it be sitting down and finding the best buddies you got? Would it be showing people how you're creating music or writing music? What are you doing with all the platforms that are out there and partners that you've got? Are there ways that you can, you know, tie into your local, if you're living here, is there a way to tie into healthcare workers and have a mini concert for them where you raise some funds for them? I mean, you know, I just think, if you still believe in yourself, you've got to go out there and do what you can to get people to notice you. And at the end of the day, you know, unfortunately, I think one of the things that's really changed right now is that there is, and you're probably not going to get a lot of love mail about this, but there is a sameness to what we're doing in this format. You do have people that are on opposite sides of the, you know, the Miranda Lamberts and the Eric Churches that are doing really interesting things on a regular basis, and people will either applaud them or, you know, castigate them because they go, oh, you know, that's not really a radio hit. And you go, well, you know, not every goddamn song you put out is going to be a radio hit. There are moments there where you just got to go feed your soul with the music, and that doesn't always translate to, you know, a number one record. And number one records in this town, I don't want to say they're a dime a dozen, but they're a whole lot easier to get than in other formats, and they don't mean as much sometimes. There's a big difference between Die a Happy Man and some other artists that I will not name that have a number one record. They both got the number one, but they don't mean the same. And that's true of a lot of artists that could have a string of number ones, and you'll go, well, I love that. And that's always a crowd pleaser. And, you know, I know that from working with Kenny. I mean, I don't know, he's got 40, 50 number one records and, you know, 25 number twos. And there are songs that he does that are number tens that do better than the number ones. You know, people respond. It doesn't mean the chart position. I think people don't know that things like, I just draw the blank right now, Independence Day from Martina, you know, got to number 19. People think, oh, no, that was a number one record. That was a huge record. No, wasn't a number one record. When You Say Nothing at All wasn't a number one record. Believe wasn't a number one record. But those records in most people's minds are number one records. What was more important than anything else, aside from the chart position, was the impact of the song, the impact of the record. And those become classics in our format. I think if you were watching the CMA when, and I'll take someone like Sarah Evans, you know, who did Born to Fly, or you take Tanya Tucker doing Delta Dawn, one record is 40-something years old, and the other record is 20-something years old, and they probably resonated better with the audience than some of the things that were current. I think that's, you're trying to make moments that will be timeless, not moments that will last for 3 minutes. I mean, I think that should be the goal. You know, I mean, yeah, we all succumb to the game, but there should be moments on those records. And I think that's what makes it tougher today for artists. Artists have a much tougher time because they're being forced into this, you know, you got to get the radio hit, you got to get the radio hit. And things that should come out and see, you know, get life, don't get life because we're in this 3 minute track business, as opposed to finding those songs like Believe that took us forever. You know, Whiskey Lullaby, those songs were over 4 minutes. When, you know, Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning was almost 5 minutes. You know, how do you get those records through today? I mean, I think that was part of what was great about our record business at that time, is our people were taught, even though everybody understood the 3 minute rule, you broke it on a regular basis. And it didn't, you didn't run from it. You realized that you were going to have a fight, but you fought for it. Today, you know, you got, oh, let's get these records up there. And there are so many records to get to one where everybody's having a number one party. And, you know, 12 months, 24 months later, nobody knows who the heck that was. And there are other people that get to number five and the song is bigger than the number one record.
Well, it's funny because when you started in the business, this was much more of a singles business, and then it turned into an albums business, and now it feels like we're kind of back in a singles business. And it also seems like in the 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes, whatever it is, when you have a number one, the fan can sometimes connect with the song more than they're actually connecting with the artist. So yeah, in order to create longing careers for the artist, you know, how do you think you keep putting out music in a time like this, or keep putting out content that's maybe more long form or, you know, streaming, but it feels like everyone's doing streaming. It feels like now that's hard to cut through. Like, is there any sort of, you know, other way to go or any other piece to it? I mean, I'm throwing out a loaded question because I feel like it's so hard to answer right now.
I don't think there, and again, I would say to you, there's not one answer for all acts. I mean, some people are just not great live, but they may be fabulous on record or fabulous on video. I mean, you know, when Shania started out, that was arguably, she made great clips and they were great records, but live, she was not great. But those records were undeniable, you know, and I think, you know, you find your strength along the way. Not all our acts that are superstars right now were fabulous when they started playing. But, you know, someone like Keith Urban, from the day he started in this town to this very moment, is a consummate entertainer. And I'm always marveling at how he is able to reinvent himself. And he will do a song that is a tempo and become a ballad playing on piano and then all of a sudden get a guitar. I mean, he just has so many tools and he uses them all, and he keeps it interesting for you and he keeps it interesting for himself. And I just think today, you know, we've got so many options for entertainment, both video and audio. And at some point it gets harder to just have the kind of longevity. And I think this is a wake up call right now, because the pandemic is a health crisis, but it's also an economic crisis. And there's going to be an impact on people for quite some time where, you know, I don't care what the government does, you can't stop money from coming into all businesses, float, you know, $500 billion out to small business and some unemployment benefits and go, okay, you know, I put some scotch tape on this, we're all back together again. It's not that simple. And so people are going to be a little more concerned with what they do with their money because they're not going to have it. This is a reset to a certain degree. I mean, you just don't wake up with this when you get slapped in the possibility of being unemployed and losing your home again, as we did, you know, what, 12 years ago? I mean, that was a startling wake-up call for a lot of people, and it took years for people to come out of that. I don't know whether it takes us a year or 2 years or three. I don't know what the numbers are. But I think it gives everybody... people are going to change behavior economically. And so what does that do? Do they become pickier? I mean, do they go back out the way they did before on live? Do they jump out into 50,000-seat arenas, stadiums to go see shows? I mean, how does that all work again? How long does it take to just come back to where we were? And it's not just the social distancing part. It's the economic part. If you're working and all of a sudden you're used to getting a bonus each year and now you're not going to get the bonus, that's a hit. Now, does that change somebody's lifestyle? Maybe not. But for other people that are being furloughed and being told, you know, you're not going to get any money, but you get health care. Well, okay, that's good news, but it's better than nothing. But it's not the same as having a steady paycheck. And so all that, it's kind of, you know, we're all in this big pond and somebody just threw a gigantic boulder in there, and it takes a moment for everything to settle down. So what does that do to consumer behavior? And I think people will become a little more picky, you know, about what they're doing, and that may have an impact on music. They may be looking for more. Like you said before, I'm looking for stuff to pick me up. That may be true. That may be what we're coming up with next, but it all can't be the same stuff.
Okay, let's go back. So everyone knows that you famously came to Nashville begrudgingly from New York, and you weren't listening to country music at the time. But when you were growing up, like, were you a music fan? What were you listening to when you were growing up?
Top 40, rock and roll. My exposure to country music was, there was a radio station, 50,000 watt daytimer, WABC, which was a legendary top 40 in New York, one of the largest in the country. And if they played Johnny Cash, you know, Ring of Fire, or they played Skeeter Davis, The End of the World, or Roger Miller, King of the Road, that's what I knew about country. So whatever was pop was my knowledge of country.
So when you started...
I grew up with the Beatles, the Dave Clark Five, the Stones, Simon and Garfunkel, the Doors. I mean, that's when I grew up.
Did you understand that the record industry was an actual thing you could go into and turn into a career?
No, not at all.
So when you get the job at RCA as a budget analyst, how'd you actually get that gig? How'd you figure out that was even a thing?
I was lucky. I went out on a career day when I was getting ready to graduate. I interviewed with General Electric. I interviewed with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I interviewed with RCA. And the guy, and RCA was a conglomerate, and they had NBC and RCA Computers and Banquet Foods and Carnet Carpets and RCA Records. And the guy that was there from RCA, just happened to be from RCA Records, liked my skills and what I had done in school and said, would you like to come to work as a budget analyst? And I went, what are you paying? When he told me the number, which at that point was $9,500, I said, yeah, that sounds really good. I'll come on board there.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening. Hope you're enjoying the episode. Some of you may know that I run an email newsletter called the Nashville Briefing. It comes out 3 times a week and it really gives you a front row seat to everything happening in our industry. So if you're interested in learning more or subscribing, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com. Okay, back to the show. So you go to RCA and you're a budget analyst. And you know, one of your mentors was Frank Mancini, and you start spending all this time with him. What kind of things were you learning from him about how to promote a record and how to, you know, go through the music business?
Well, Frank, I'll digress for a second. So Frank worked with a lot of legendary acts back from the 50s and 60s. And he's just one of those guys that he was such an affable individual. Anybody he met, he could get along with and charm them. And he was just an old school record guy. He had a big smile all the time, was always welcoming. Even when he was dressing you down, it wasn't in harsh tones, and you kind of got dressed down and went, boy, that was good. You know, he's just one of those very special guys. And so he would let me come up and sit on the couch in his office, and I'd listen to him with his staff as you talk to him about music and where to go and how to get around this guy, and if you called this guy and you thought about this approach and how we dealt with the artists. And then when he would go to dinner at night with, you know, whether the artists, Harry Nilsson and Ringo Starr, or sitting there and taking his promo guys out, I don't know what it was, but he just said, you want to come along? And I was a sponge. I fell in love. And what I was good at was I knew the numbers, because my responsibility was for the finances of the company. I knew how all the departments worked and how the budgets worked, and Frank was terrible at math, terrible. And I helped him in a lot of those cases, and so he just kept letting me listen, and I'd ask him questions. Well, why does this record work here, and why does that record not work there, and what does this radio station do, and who is this guy? And he just took me under his wing and took me out, and so I learned people management, people skills. I learned the ability that you got to work long and hard to get there. It's about knowing people and spending the time with them and caring about them and making sure they understand that, about integrity. He was there. And the interesting thing about him is he wound up at one point getting fired. He wound up driving a cab in New York because he couldn't get back in the business because he was too old. And wound up working for Cablevision, became a senior vice president of Cablevision, and when the company went public, made out millions of dollars in like when he was in his 50s. So, but he was just that guy, you know. Anybody you run into, so you know Frank. Oh, I love Frank. Frank's just—he's just the greatest guy, you know. And that's what Frank was.
It's really not an understatement at all to say that you are really credited with, you know, changing the ways early on in the 80s and 90s of how this town operates. And a lot of the way it operates now can be traced back to you. Do you credit that foundation to Frank?
Not to his methods. Frank was not an innovator in that sense. Frank was just a great people person. And in order to do what I did in my entire career, I was blessed and good at being able to pick people to help me. I knew what I didn't know, and I made sure I had people around to help me that were also honest with me. You know, Butch Wall used to say, he had this expression called "got a minute," and it was whenever I heard Butch say, "you got a minute," I knew we had a problem. And Butch would go, "well, you know, let me tell you what's going on here," you know, or Randy Goodman. I mean, so just people that I've been around all my life, whether it be, you know, at the label or just as friends, that would go, "hey, you know, let me tell you what's going on here and what people are saying about this." And I would check in. I was always, always out. Everybody would tell you that I was out every day, seeing acts, talking to people, meeting with them, going to lunch, meeting with the competition. I met with everybody I could just to get information, to understand how the agency business worked, how the management business worked, why the charts worked the way they did, how do you cross a record? I just kept trying to find people to help us. And what was inside of me was I was this guy from New York who was respected when I was in New York and at the label, And then I came down here and everybody thought, well, he's a hillbilly, he doesn't know shit. And it really pissed me off that, you know, the format that I was working in, sure, we had warts like everybody else, but there was a lot of good music coming out of this town and people wouldn't give it the time of day. And I was still young enough and full of piss and vinegar to go, well, screw you. Shit, this is just Waylon Jennings is as good as anything else that's out there. I'm going to show you how it's going to work. And we crossed, God, in the 80s and 90s. I mean, we had number one pop records. You know, we jumped, you know, with Dolly Parton, we were jumping, you know, the Bee Gees. I mean, it was, we just, you know, I had great people around me and I made great friends along the way and I took care of my friends and my friends took care of me. And that's the way it was for my career. I tried to do the right things as often as I could, and I'm not saying I was the perfect guy, but, you know, I knew that I was good to the artists because I can't sing and I can't write and I can't play and they can. And I always used to tell my staff, unless you can do it better than they can, you do everything you can to make sure they get the right opportunity because we've got their careers in our hands. And people, you know, I took care of my people and my people took care of me. And it was a great run for decades, but, you know, the idea was we kept trying to do it better, and the more people would tell us we couldn't do it because we were country, we would reinvent the wheel on a constant basis. And people, you know, the window of opportunity, the whole concept that there was a point in a record's life that was a window where there was peak airplay, and that was the time to release your album, was a concept that, you know, we figured out. And then everybody started to adopt it, you know, building the decks that we did to be able to help launch records, you know, the promo tours that we went through, the bus tours that we went through, how to do it differently, you know, even technology to the point of our folks having the best technology when people were still trying to do things, you know, using pay telephones, you know, giving our folks, you know, although they StarTAC, you know, just what is the edge that we can do to make our staff better? And then, you know, unfortunately for some people, I was really hard on judging folks. And if you were not really a performer in my mind, then we turned over people. And I would say we were turning over people at the rate of, you know, 15 or 20% a year. I don't think we ever kept a staff on that was, it started 1 year and ended the same year without making changes along the way.
So in 1982, you actually become the head of RCA Nashville, and you're the youngest head of a Nashville label. And at the time, I mean, I'm assuming that there were probably people on the team that were older than you. Were you intimidated to be in that role, or did you feel, you know, incredibly confident in your ability, or you know, like were you intimidated in that role at all?
No, I wasn't intimidated. I felt like I had worked to get there. Sure. And to your point, if you go back and look at the records, I wasn't made president. I was made head of Nashville Entertainment Music Organization, affectionately known as NEMO. They were unsure whether or not I was going to be able to handle the job. Until the year after I was named NEMO, then I was appointed to head of the label. And so it's one of those things where they weren't sure that I could do the job, even though I had been basically doing it with Jerry, because Jerry did some of the A&R, and then I just went about everything else from there. And so the only thing that was new to me at that point was, okay, being the A&R person, the head of A&R, and building an A&R staff. And that was new, and that was intimidating, and obviously you make mistakes. But, you know, right after that, you know, we signed Whitley and Deborah Allen and the Judds, and so we were kind of off to the races, and MKT and Restless Heart and Quinn Flack and Lori Morgan, and, you know, it was a golden period of time for, you know, 20, 25 years of acts.
Okay, going back to what you just said a second ago, how did you meet Waylon Jennings for the first time? Do you remember the first encounter?
Yeah. So there was a guy in our office whose job was kind of publicity and artist relations. He was a former DJ from Cleveland, Ohio. His name was Paul Randall. He's long gone now. But Paul, when he was at radio, had met Waylon, and Waylon was recording over at Glazer Brothers Studio. And I had seen Waylon at an event down here, but I had never met him. And Paul came into my office, and it was probably 6 o'clock at night, and he said, "Hey, you know, Waylon's recording, you want to go over there?" Now, mind you, we were pretty much prohibited from going to outside studios because we had company-owned studios, and the only person that really recorded outside was Waylon, and to a certain degree, Porter over at his Fireside Studios. But nobody, you know, Joey and Chet didn't really encourage us to do that. And so I said, "Sure, we'll go do that." So we went in, you know, it was what you would picture, a bunch of characters in the room, and everybody having a good time, lots of smoke, lots of booze, and some other things along the way. Sat down on the couch, and Paul said, "Hey, Waylon." He goes, "Hi, Paul." And he said, "This is Joe." And Waylon said, "Hey, Hoss." And he just kept on going. You know, the whole leather vest, the hat, and everything else. You know, big smile and everything. But you could tell you did not want to screw with Waylon.
One of the things I love about your career is that there's so much variety. And I think there's so many people you've worked with who, you know, at first glance, maybe obviously aren't a star, and then they turn into the biggest star on the planet. Like, did Waylon have that sort of star quality? Could he control a room and sort of make it feel a little bit cooler?
When he was on stage, yes. When he was by himself, no. He was. I think his quote was, "I'm an introvert living in an extrovert's world." You know, in print, he was brilliant when he would do an interview, if he was straight. You know, you had to deal with that. That was my first experience really with drugs. And, you know, we were going to get Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But, I mean, I have to tell you, I had more problems with people around him than I did with him. And we got to trust one another. And I have a letter somewhere from him that we presented him with a plaque for, I think, 10 million units on the old legendary General Jackson boat show. And he wrote me a letter that I had framed where he said, "You'll be my friend forever, and I have total respect for you." And it's a really big thing for me because, you know, he was one of the reasons why I wound up staying in Nashville. I just believed so much in him. And I remember going to a promotion meeting when we had Mamas Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys, and we were starting to get some pop stations to play the record, and I went to the Nashville promotion meeting. And this guy who was in charge of the promotion department, Ray Anderson, who also has passed away, was a good-looking, good promotion guy, but he really just liked pop music, and I played him the song. And the guys that were the locals from the Southeast and Southwest were like, they were salivating, and he went, "What the fuck do you want me to do with the goddamn cowboy music?" I looked at him and I said, "Get the fucking thing on the goddamn air in the Southeast and Southwest, and then we'll talk again." You know, and that's what happened. We got it on, and it worked. And it's just, you know, Waylon made records, as we were talking about before, on Miranda and Eric, you know, which I find they have the same kind of qualities, you know, and I don't know whether, I mean, I know they both had Waylon as an influence and Willie as an influence, but it's just that I'm not going to follow things just because it's the easy way. You know, sometimes it'll work. When we put out the "It's a Good Old Boy," the theme from the Dukes of Hazzard, Waylon, we actually used the quote in an ad that said, "I couldn't go pop with a mouthful of firecrackers." And that record became a top 20 pop record. I mean, it was a nothing song. He didn't want it out, but it didn't make any difference. The people loved that record, and people will still sing it today. You know, and it's just, that wasn't his proudest moment. In terms of what I think he created, he did it because it was an opportunity and it was a payday, not because he was really thrilled about it. He needed to, you know, he had financial problems back then and he kind of made it through, but he's also the same guy that made Dream of My Dreams with Jack Clement. So, I mean, that kind of guy deserves your respect.
So I can't have you on this phone call without talking about the Wu-Tang Clan. You end up back in New York in 1990, you start working out, you move to New York and you sign, I mean, Dave Matthews and so many others and the Wu-Tang Clan. I want to know how you signed the Wu-Tang Clan, and I'm curious if there is anything you learned in Nashville or in country music that you were able to apply to the Wu-Tang Clan.
That's the first time I've been asked that question. in terms of applying an income nationally. I would tell you that, well, first of all, there was a guy we had in New York that I think I was 40, let me think here for a second. So that was 90, so 30 years ago. Yeah, I was 40 years old. So I moved to New York and started meeting people, and it was like being in the desert without any water because nobody wanted to give me a hand to kind of get an advantage anywhere. So everything we did on our own. And there was a guy named Julie Rifkin who was a promotion guy in the R&B format. He had a son named Steve Rifkin, and I had known Julie. And he had his son come over, and Steve was a promo guy, but he was really a Jewish white guy who loved hip-hop, just loved hip-hop. And he came in, and he said, he's just full of shit. I mean, just somebody that you go in, you go, this guy is going to break things. I'm not sure if this is real or bullshit, but there's something about him that says, give this guy a chance. And so we created a label. And he signed a band called The Alcoholics, which did a little bit of noise, but not much. Another act, which I cannot remember, but it was a rapper that wound up, that actually was getting a buzz, and the guy actually shot himself accidentally and died. And then he came through with the Wu-Tang Clan. And it was one of those moments where, and Randy Goodman was with me at that point, you know, we hear this music, and it's like, now this is, and you had that point, there was this battle between the East Coast and the West Coast. And Onyx was a West Coast band, and then you had the Wu-Tang guys who were from the East Coast, and they were hardcore. And we just fell in love with the music as a company and as individuals. And it was really different for us because our relationship at that point was with Jive. And Jive had Boogie Down Productions and Will Smith, and all they were really big into hip-hop, and we were not. So it was the first time we had really stepped out with this little label deal. And Wu-Tang just got all the credibility in the world, gave us all the credibility in the world to start doing things in the hip-hop world. And it was, there were lots of moments in that entire relationship where, you know, I mean, one thing you never did with the country acts is go in there and smoke a blunt. But, I mean, with Wu-Tang Clan, you know, shit, that was going on a regular basis. You get a contact high just from being in a room with them. And it was a lot of, you know, the one thing I did take with from Nashville is, you know, if you give acts respect, you do it the right way, they'll give you some rope. And that's, I did take that lesson to them. And I, you know, I said, look, guys, I'm not going to tell you I'm the expert in hip hop, and you guys are from the street, and I'm willing to work with you, but I'm an expert in what I do. So let's figure out how to do this together. And I found the guys really, in terms of relationship wise, we had a really good relationship over the course of time. It wasn't a long relationship because, I mean, I think we put out two albums and then I had moved back to Nashville, but you know, that was, for the company, it was certainly, an important moment for RCA. And I remember going overseas and playing that music and everybody looking at me like, you guys have lost your mind. And we had, because it was never an international record, but domestically it became iconic.
Do you trust your instincts with the record? I mean, like I said earlier, you have such a variety of acts that you're known for working for and signing. Is it your instincts that you're trusting over everything else? Or how do you make a decision about who to work with when it comes to the bottom line?
Well, it'd be disingenuous for me to say that was my instinct. That was the instinct of Rifkin. And then we had a department of kids that were in hip hop who just went, this is the shit. And so, you know, what you're supposed to do is, you know, plant a lot of flowers and water them. Some of them are going to die and some of them are going to grow. And that's what that was. It was an experiment in people and a belief in, you know, I'm going to give these guys a chance. And we immediately began to see signs when where it got added, Hot 97 as a record. And, you know, it just, you had to be blind not to see what was going on. Now, there was an issue because you couldn't get the record beyond the East Coast, although that didn't stop us from, you know, having a platinum album. But it didn't go to the West Coast because there was that war between the East Coast and West Coast. And we never really had a hit act from the West Coast. So, you know, I have to tell you, it's even the same is true of Dave Matthews. Dave Matthews came through our college intern program. You know, the kid came up with a cassette and started playing it for people, and soon one A&R person said to another A&R person, and, you know, then it came to me, and we went down to Wetlands at 2 o'clock in the morning to watch Dave Matthews, and returning to Butch Juan, I went, do you have any clue what to do with this? And he said, no. I said, neither do I. I said, but this shit is great. We can't lose this. We've got to hold on to this and figure out what we do. And that's what we did. We wanted the band. We had an idea of what to do, and we created an independent label because nobody thought if it came out on RCA, they would believe it was really as good as it is. But if it was an independent record, and it was blowing up and we signed it, everybody would have more credibility. They would, the band would, and we did. And that's what we did. When MTV added the video, they didn't know it was on RCA. We had already signed the band. We just created a ruse so that people wouldn't put us in the corner because we were the corporate label. So, I mean, it was, you know, there were a lot of things going on back then that just were unique. And we, as I started out, I told you about people. There were people all the way through my career that have caused me to make decisions based on listening to their arguments or listening to their passion that sometimes were right and sometimes were wrong, you know. And fortunately in our business, you don't have to be right all the time. You just got to be right a number of times and consistently. And I think that's really what a great record company does. It's consistent. You know, and, you know, I remember when Tracy Chapman was signed to the SBK, and SBK immediately, maybe it was Elektra she was on, and they immediately made the person that signed them senior VP, and that person never had another signing after that. You know, the consistency is what you're paying for, and that's what we did. We kept people that were consistently good, both from an A&R standpoint or a production standpoint or, you know, the artists themselves. I mean, you know, we stayed with people. We believed in them as long as they worked as hard as we did. You know, we tried to be fair. I don't think – that's one thing I am proud of is that I don't think you're going to find people that have worked for me or with me or on the label that said, what an asshole. You just completely fucked me over, you know. I mean, you never gave me a chance. I mean, even people that I dropped came back and said, you know what? You gave me a chance. Maybe I didn't have the right music at that time. Maybe I wasn't right, the right label. You know, Vince Gill and I are friends to this day. We had some hits, but we never made the right record. When we let him go and he went over to MCA on the fourth single on that album, you know, he will say it to you. He said the first person that stood up when he got his CMA award was me. I was the first person out of my chair going, yay, Vinny. Because we just didn't have the right chemistry in terms of the creative side. But as a people, I love Vince Gill. I think he's one of the great singers of our format and one of the greatest people we've ever had in this town.
So you famously, obviously, returned to Nashville after New York. And then, you know, there's so many acts that you've worked with, it's kind of overwhelming to go through them. You know, Carrie Underwood, Brad Paisley, Kenny Chesney. I mean, when Kenny Chesney first came into your office, I'm assuming he didn't look like Kenny Chesney looks now. Like, what did he look like when he first came into your office?
Pretty much what that first album cover looks like, the mullet with the dark hat, the dark cowboy hat, ill-fitting clothes. It was a George Strait wannabe. You know, and I mean, there was something about his voice. I mean, I'd made the deal through Dale Morris. Dale Morris, I was getting ready to be back, and he FedExed the album to me in Connecticut when I was up there on the weekend. I listened to it over the weekend and called him back. I said, you know, I really like what I'm hearing. You know, I'll do this deal. I'll take the shot. You and I have been in business a long time and done really well together. You're telling me you believe in this kid? You know, let's go do it. And, you know, we were able to get him away and signed them to the label, and we had a hit, and we had a miss, and we had a hit, and we had a miss, and then Clinton and I got together with him because Clinton was managing him full time at that point, and both of us sat down with him and said, you know, just as I said to you earlier, you sound like you're trying to make records for everybody else. You just got to start making records for yourself, and you need to look like not George Strait, but who's Kenny Chesney? And Kenny got so pissed off Storm, this is after the ACM show, and stormed out of the room. And when he came back, Kenny, to his credit, you know, all of a sudden we've got this rock and roll t-shirt, cutoffs, the tight jeans. He starts working out. I don't, you know, I mean, he was always athletic, but he really got focused on it. And the music changed. You know, he really started to bring an edge to his music, and he found his brand. And I invested in the Kenny Chesney business, and he and I, to this day, are still in business together.
How do you, we kind of mentioned it earlier, but just generally across the music industry, you'll see acts that will have, you know, will put out a record, and that one record won't work, and the label will lose confidence and drop them. And then there's other acts where, like, there's a hit, there's not a hit, or there's no hits out of the gate, and the label's still investing. Like, how do you make the decision? I'm sure it's case by case, but what, like, you know, with some acts, how do you decide, okay, this isn't working or not as well as we could be, but there is something here and we're going to push forward? Like, where does that come from?
It's a mixture of, you know, do you find between the last album and this album, maybe you picked up additional markets that you didn't have before and you're getting good feedback, or there are dates that are working that you're, again, getting good feedback from promoters. Is it, you know, they like the act, they don't like the music? Is it the producer's not really captured because they haven't seen the act live? I mean, I always think that's an issue. You know, people make records, but they don't ever go to see the act. And I think that's an issue for how you capture what that person's all about. But it's each of those artists that I went through, when we stumbled, you know, Sarah Evans wound up having platinum albums, but the first album that she made was tremendous in terms of critical acclaim. The town absolutely loved her, you know, and she was trying to channel retro country, and that was not going to work. And we made it with Pete Anderson, and he's a great player and a great producer, but it wasn't, he convinced her that she needed to go all the way over to the left, and there was no place to go with over to the left. And we convinced her to come back more to center, and she found her place. And, you know, she was a great singer on the first record, and she was a great singer on the second record. And little by little, we started to center in on what she was doing that worked. And there were other people like the Warren Brothers, for Christ's sake, you know, signed those guys three times. And they, you know, I probably just should have done the publishing deal with them, and I would have made a hell of a lot more money. But, you know, everybody, Tim McGraw took them out as openers. Kenny Chesney took them out as openers. Everybody loved what they did live. They can entertain. But they weren't making the right records, and they themselves will tell you they were not ready to be artists. They were having way too much fun, you know. And so it's just, it depended, you know, and there comes a time, you know, because I was always the guy that would pick up the phone and call them and drop them. And, you know, other people would say, you can't drop them. And I would say, well, tell me why, what else can we do? When I've known that you guys have worked your asses off and we put as much money as we can, but we're not getting anywhere. You know, if you're not getting anything back, if you get a record to top 20, and at that point it was really about sales and requests, and if you couldn't get anything out of those on a consistent basis, then I needed to open up that slot for somebody else. And it's not easy, but that's what you're supposed to do. You just can't stay in the same place. And sometimes those acts would leave, you know, in the case of Vince, and went someplace else, and he'd be successful. In other cases, people would leave, and nothing happened.
So I have to ask for my own selfish purposes, because Brad Paisley was the first country artist that I fell in love with, and definitely is one of the main reasons I wanted to move to Nashville early on in my life. Any great Brad Paisley stories or anything fun about working with him?
Brad was, he's another guy that transformed. You know, if you look, you know, when he first came out, what a traditionalist he was. And if you went to those shows, he would tell you, I'm not listening to Nashville, I'm listening to you, that whole shtick that he did. And then, you know, we forged a partnership where commercially, you know, I was always impressed with Brad's creativity. I mean, I just could not believe his ability to be as clever as he was, part Merle Haggard and part Roger Miller. And, you know, as a player, I don't think people understood how good he really was. And I used to always bust his chops about, you know, you make it look so easy. Make people think it's a little harder than it is, for Christ's sake, you know? I mean, but he came in because I was notorious for not always loving video because I thought we were starting to spend way too much money on videos, and I was one of those data guys that I kept looking for, is this really making a difference? And a lot of cases, we were just making clips and it wasn't making a difference. It was just filling up space. So Brad came in, and it was on Celebrity, and he wanted to do a video. And I can't remember what the budget was. I can't remember that he asked for $150,000 or $200,000, which was a lot of money. But I, you know, he had come up and he painted this whole picture of how he wanted to do it. And I was a big fan of Brad's creativity, as I said. And obviously he had done some really great work along the way. And so, you know, he's pleading his case and blah, blah, blah. And I looked at him and I said, okay, go do it. Well, his manager, Bill Simmons, called me later on and goes, well, Joe, I got good news and I got bad news. I said, what's that? He said, Brad's really excited that you believe in him and gave him the money. I said, that's great. I said, what's the bad news? He has no goddamn idea what he's going to do. But he figured it out.
It's a great music video.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's the thing, you know, those guys. But then you can get too wrapped up in, you know, then it becomes everything's got to be gone with the wind. And sometimes simplicity is more to the point. So, you know, but Brad was—he was great to work with. I mean, I adore him, and I still think he's a very. Those records were to me again timeless. Whiskey Lullaby, and I Get Where I'm Going. I mean, just he was really good about, you know, even the gospel side of him on each album. I think that's what connected him in so many ways. He was really good about that. You know, figuring out again, who is he? What does he stand for? I mean, who does that today anymore?
So you end up becoming the chairman of Sony Nashville, and you're there until 2010, and then you decide to step down. Had you had enough? Like, how did you make the decision to ultimately to step down?
I got to the point where I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. If I could have, and it was more corporation than it was anything else. I think I was... I don't think I know. At that point, I had put everything else in my life on hold. My family was definitely secondary. I was always gone. You know, I really didn't think about anything else except work. That's all I did. I mean, I worked. I was on the road, and I worked. I was gone 300 days a year, and if I wasn't on the road, I was always gone at night. And it just, you know, when I left, I was 60. I mean, all the guys today that are running labels are in their 60s and they're doing that. But, you know, I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. I felt, to your point, Zach, when you talk about my career and I thought about the moments, you know, the 9 to 5, the Waylon Jennings, the Carrie Underwood, the Kenny Chesney, even Foster and Lloyd, A Restless Heart, all the things I had been through and the events in my life, you know, and I just kind of went, when I get to the top of each of these mountains, the view isn't as exhilarating. I just didn't feel the same about a number one record or a platinum record or, you know, I mean, the last great joy I had at that point was Miranda. And, you know, I just felt like we were entering that period in terms of music where I didn't feel the same way about it. And I also began to think about, there were guys in my lifetime that I had watched stay on in the job past the point where they were effective. And they did it for the paycheck, and it prevented other people from coming up and getting the chance. And I didn't need to do that. I wanted to find out what else I could do in life and to a certain degree give back. And so that's what I started to do, is I started, you know, I'm still working at the CMA and on the foundation and the CMA itself, and felt like it was my time to give back. When I joined the EC, it was giving back. When I joined AIDS Garden for Alzheimer's, it was give back. I mean, I had some time to be able to do things that would give back to the town that helped me so much. And that's what I got joy out of. And then I started morphing into different businesses and had learned a whole lot by getting on public boards. It's really helped me as an executive and given me another chapter in my life and given me a different view on things. And so I'm still in touch with the music through Clint and Kenny, and that crew have been really gracious about involving me in everything they do. And other people will still call for information. And I take great pride in connecting people along the way when I can. The Mayor's Music Council, working on with them, you know, with Megan and Carl Dean and David Briley, trying to help out growing the music business and getting companies to move here. Those are all things that I'm proud of. As I didn't just leave, I just kept giving back to the, you know, the town and the music that I've got. And I still have a tremendous amount of friends, and I've got people that I turn to for information and, you know, help and guidance on a regular basis. And it's been good. I mean, you know, I didn't enjoy the corporate. I've been through too many changes on the corporate side. I think I counted at one point I had, you know, 18 bosses in 40 years, and it just got to be, you know, annoying to go back and just keep trying to prove yourself. And, you know, for a long period of time, until we got to probably 2016 or 17, when streaming started to take off, that 6-year period, and everybody went, boy, you were a freaking genius getting out when you did, because it just went down the tubes for a long period of time. It was really, really hard. Now streaming has helped these guys out. But I really did look at it and say that, you know, we need to keep a change of the guard. I mean, I really do believe in that. There's a point at which you need to grow your staff and let people have an opportunity to kind of rise to the top. And, you know, I had my time, and I'm really proud of what I did, and I'm appreciative of people like you calling up and saying, hey, what the hell was that all about? But, you know, it was time for me to move on.
Well, this has been such a pleasure and such a thrill for me. And as someone who grew up in New York, who is a New Yorker, and, you know, fell in love with Nashville and decided to move to Nashville, I've always looked up to you in a way as someone who can be a New Yorker and someone with a New York mentality and still make it in this town. So it's just been a thrill to talk to you right now. So thank you so much for taking the time.
You're more than welcome. You be safe and be well.
Absolutely. Have a great day. Talk soon.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and I'm so excited for you to hear next week's episode with Razor and Tie co-founder Craig Balsam. If you want to know how two guys quit their jobs as lawyers and created one of the most recognizable label brand names, then this episode is for you. Oh, and we definitely talk about Kidz Bop, so be sure to tune in. Special thanks to Justin Johnson for creating our theme music, and the Zach Hume Show is mixed by Sam Heyman. Big thank you again to Joe Galante for taking the time to talk. I know how busy he keeps the schedule, so we really appreciate it, and it was such a thrill, so thank you, Joe. If you want the latest updates in country music, you can subscribe to our newsletter at NashvilleBriefing.com, and don't forget to follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye.